TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports,
baby!
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
Score! On the rebound! Steven Stamkos!
Set play by the Twins!
Evander Kane, the long shot that fools Lundqvist!
We're managing the puck a lot better. I think we're getting the puck to the goal line and doing the things that's required to win.
And the Jets go 4-1 on the five-game road trip.
The big plays. The big stories. The biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. 2 hours of hockey talk for you on this Wednesday evening. Coming up in 30 minutes' time, the assistant general manager of the Phoenix Coyotes, Brad Treliving, is going to join us to talk about the Coyotes organization. Coming up at 7:15 this evening, Dan Wood, he's the Anaheim Ducks color commentator on 830 KLAA, their radio flagship station, is going to join us to talk about the Anaheim Ducks. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with your latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is www.IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, we start this Wednesday evening. First of all, hello. We start this Wednesday evening with the NHL's proposed realignment that has been bandied about and talked about for a number of weeks. But finally, what is likely to be the final proposal was released yesterday to various members of the media, and I have to say that I don't think it's perfect. I think it is probably still going to come to fruition.
Well, hello, Drew. Hello, Richie. First of all, it looks like when the Board of Governors meet at the end of March, this is what is going to be voted on and most likely approved. There, we were talking about this off air, and you know, when this came out and the memorandum was circulated to all the teams and it was shared to the media, or really it was leaked out to the media, there was one, you know, noticeable element that wasn't changed. And it's that there's 16 teams in the East, 14 in the West. And, you know, the concession seems to be that now there will be a playoff, and it's possible that five teams in each conference division, I guess we'll call them conferences for now, can still make the playoffs.
Well, let me break.
However, there's still the question of imbalance.
Let me explain it, how it works. Is you have two conferences. You have the Western Conference and the Eastern Conference.
Right.
Inside each of the two conferences, there are two divisions. So there's four divisions in total. The Atlantic, the Central, the Midwest, and the Pacific. So the Midwest and the Pacific are in the Western Conference. The Atlantic and the Central are in the Eastern Conference. The problem is that each of the divisions in the Eastern Conference have 8 teams per division, whereas each of the divisions in the Western Conference have 7 teams per division. The Winnipeg Jets would be in the Midwest division in the Western Conference. They'd be joined by the St. Louis Blues, the Nashville Predators, the Minnesota Wild, the Dallas Stars, the Colorado Avalanche, and the Chicago Blackhawks. Pretty much every team in the Central time zone, with the exception of Colorado, who are in the Mountain time zone.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much it's based on time zones. The bulk of your problem is you have 16 teams that play in the Eastern time zone, and you have 14 teams that play in the Central, Mountain, and Pacific time zones, and that is where the imbalance comes into play. The NHL has acquiesced to the wishes of both the Detroit Red Wings and the Columbus Blue Jackets, two teams that play in the Eastern time zone that currently play in the Western Conference. Under the current format, they've realigned them into the Eastern Conference.
There is a competitive imbalance, I think, Drew, by, you know, the way they've structured this. But I think it also needs to be said that there's a little bit of a competitive imbalance right now.
Yep.
Meaning they allow teams, in weaker divisions to have a higher seed in the conference. They have division-heavy schedules, so if a team pays, you know, a team like the Jets, for example, are the benefactors of the schedule this year because it's an easy schedule. They're playing all the not very good teams more often than the other teams. So if you're the Rangers, if you're the Rangers, you're playing Pittsburgh five times, and you're the Jets. You're playing Florida five times. And instead of having, you know, because the point is this. You're all playing for the same eight spots. I realize that there's a seed for the division winner. But for the remaining five spots after the division winners, guys, you know, you're having a team like Pittsburgh compete with a team like the Jets when the Jets have a far easier schedule than do the Penguins. They don't play an equal – they're not on equal footing. They don't play every team the same amount of times. So that needs to be taken into account too. Now, does this – you know, does this new system fix the problem? I don't know, and I realize that obviously there's an advantage for the divisions with seven teams, but if every owner is okay with it, then I'm okay with it.
And you mentioned competitive imbalance, Richie, and there is a competitive imbalance. Most likely, a team that isn't very good is going to get a higher seed than a better team in the Atlantic Division. And right now we are talking about the Southeast Division. Nobody has emerged. Right now the third seed in the Southeast Division is by far not the best out of the top three seeds. But, you know, Drew, you mentioned, you know, we're talking about the schedule, and Elliot Friedman broke this on Saturday, and we mentioned it on IllegalCurve.com. Dave Manuk posted it on IllegalCurve.com, and he mentioned that this schedule, when they sent out the memo for the schedule, they said that they're going to there's an option after the 2015-2016 season to see if it's working and reevaluate. Mm-hmm. I think that's important because, as we know, if there is going to be expansion into Quebec City and Toronto/Markham/Hamilton,
right,
then you might as well completely not maybe erase what they've come up with now. But now you've got two more Eastern teams, so you're not going to put 18 teams in the East and 14 teams in the West. Now you're going to probably have to do a 16-16 split. So there, 2 years from after next year, there might be even bigger changes coming.
And the problem you have with, whoa, it's only the eighth, you know, the last seed who's going to be missing out. You know, that argument doesn't really hold water because what happened last year?
The last seed, the Los Angeles Kings, won the Stanley Cup.
So that argument doesn't go so far.
You know what my biggest problem with this new realignment is? That they refer to the division that includes Boston, Buffalo, Detroit, Florida, Montreal, Ottawa, Tampa, and Toronto, that they refer to that division as the Central Division. In what universe are those places central to anything besides thinking that the center of their own world?
There you go.
I mean, don't call it the Central Division. Call it the Eastern. I mean, well, I know it's whatever you know, whatever you want to call it. It's not the Central Division.
Why don't they go back to the old four names?
Sure, go back to the Norris and the Smythe and everything else.
I think Richie has nailed it. I think, you know, first off, the names now are just awful. I mean, Central, Pacific, North. I mean, those are so generic and terrible, and aren't even reflective of where the team is located geographically.
That's my point. I mean, everything else is okay. I'm okay, sort of, with the Pacific, including Calgary and Edmonton. I mean, it's not really the Pacific, but whatever, I can live with it. And Midwest, being Chicago and Dallas and Minnesota.
Yep.
Sure, okay,
Winnipeg,
fine. Yep. Sort of down, you know, I'm okay with that in some respects. And the Atlantic Division, including, you know, the Islanders and the Rangers, well, they're on the Atlantic Ocean pretty much. Again, I'm okay with that. But Central for these other cities is what doesn't make any sense to me. Miami, Florida is Central? Central to what exactly?
Well, let's go over. I mean, if you look at back to the math of it, Drew, you know, if you're looking at the chances of a team, if you're in an eight-team division, you have a 12.5% chance of making the playoffs. We went over this on the show before a while back when they proposed it. And if you're in a seven-team division, you have a 14% chance or 15%
about there,
chance,
give or take.
So I mean,
14 point something.
Yeah, well, so what happens is you're giving up that percentage just by being geographically obviously located somewhere.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, and back to my point earlier, if the owners are okay with it, they're happy to be in the, you know, they're happy that the Eastern Conference is entirely in the Eastern time zone, and the owners say, okay, you know, we'll take the extra, you know, or the minus 2% chance that we won't make the playoffs. We'll roll the dice and say, hey, you know, we hope we're better than that, and they all collectively say that, or at least the majority say that, then
And the players are okay giving up that same percentage because they get a reduced travel schedule, and it's a lot easier on them. And if you're Detroit, instead of playing, you know, five games a year in Los Angeles and Phoenix, you play five games a year in Boston and Toronto and Montreal, which are a lot easier to travel to. So, I mean, not the perfect scenario, and once expansion or teams move comes into play, this might be a complete and total disaster again. But for now, it's probably the best of a mediocre situation.
It's easy to spout off and talk about the numbers, but practically, what is in every team's best interest? And that's the question to ask. And I think this probably is in most teams' best interest, considering the travel adjustments for Detroit, for Columbus, for Winnipeg, especially Winnipeg. You not only get the travel adjustment, you get into a 7-team division.
Right. Absolutely. And I'll drop another name we've had on the show numerous times. Sean Gordon wrote a great article, pardon me, in the Globe and Mail today about realignment, and he basically said that this is exactly what we're talking about with the imbalance, but a Detroit team is able to stomach it and wants it because now they're with Toronto, they're with Montreal, they're with Boston, all the big revenue teams, and they're willing to maybe forego the advantages that they have by playing with Columbus and other teams in the division they're currently in. But you look at what's also an option is with the crossover, meaning if you're a lower seed in one conference, you might end up creating a rivalry with another team, an original six team, for example. So, I mean, there are positives and negatives, but it's like you said, Drew, I mean, what they're in a position right now where they can't just flip-flop Winnipeg for another team.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when it is a little bit complex because you can't have 15 and 15 for obvious reasons. So really right now this is kind of what they've come up with. And I think we'd all agree in this room that a couple of years from now there could be three or four teams moving around and could have a completely different format.
The fact that they write it into the proposal or into whatever is eventually agreed upon that they'll revisit this 3 years down the road and they're doing it as a partnership between the players and the Players Association, that's their out. That pretty much tells any team that might, that might end up with an NHL franchise between now and 3 years from now that, part of getting this franchise is you're stuck with this alignment for the minimum of 3 years.
We also ought to talk about the division playoff system.
Right. And the division playoff system is it's in division for the first two rounds like it used to be.
Yep.
So that the first place team in the... and we're going to assume there's no crossovers as we go through this. So first place team in the Midwest division plays the fourth place team in the Midwest division. Second place third. Then the winners play each other. And then the winners of that play the winner of each division will play against the other division in their conference. And that is the team that is declared will represent this that conference in the Stanley Cup.
I don't mind that either. I don't mind the creating the rivalries. And
exactly.
And you also may preserve better matchups for later on, if a Philly and I don't remember the exact conferences, Drew, but whatever it may be, two teams that are bitter rivals but in different conferences and they're clearly the best teams, they may not happen to meet in the second round. They can only meet in the third.
And hey, but I know Remo is a big baseball fan. I know you guys are big baseball fans. You have divisional playoffs. This is kind of what you're getting here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're having first versus fourth in your own conference. And I agree with Richie. It's good for rivalries, and it's fair as well. And in the Eastern Conference, you're going to have a more difficult time trying to make the playoffs. But that's what that's the way it is for now. That's the way it has to be split up.
And you know what? The teams in the Eastern Conference, even though there's eight teams in their conference, they have an easier travel schedule than the teams in the West. So you said, there's pros and cons for every team involved, and they live with it. Before we go to break, quick shout out to the grade 5 and 6 classes at the Gray Academy. Richie and I were down there earlier this week reading to them for I Love to Read Month.
I heard you guys did a great job.
Yes, we enjoyed the kids, smart kids.
I wasn't invited because I'm illiterate.
Yes, that's what we figured, exactly. Smart kids, they asked some tremendous questions about hockey, kept us on our toes, and a real fun time with the grade 5 and 6 classes at the Gray Academy. And Maddie Leibel of the Big Show was there for the grade 4 class as well. Anyways, let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
We were talking off air just about life.
Yeah,
and
like we do.
Michael,
deep in ponderance.
Exactly. Michael Remus, our excellent producer, was talking about how he was speaking to a girl, I guess since the last time we saw him. And
already newsworthy.
Very newsworthy. And the reason she contacted him was to find out who won the Jets game, and she contacted him this morning.
No, last night.
No, it was last night.
She couldn't go on the smartphone?
She said she didn't have internet.
But she texted you. I guess that's
technically, her story does hold up, but realistically, it doesn't really hold. It doesn't hold much weight.
Do girls know how to go to TSN.ca and look at scores?
Yeah, they do.
They know,
and you'll hear about them after that comment, I suspect.
Well, Reem, I think there's just one thing that we can, you know, take from this is that this girl has it really bad for you.
Okay.
She's texting you to find out the Jets game. All you have to do is walk outside of your door and someone's cheering for the Jets beating the Rangers. So this girl is, she's got it bad. She's smitten by you.
What do you guys think of the uneven teams in realignment?
you're not getting out that easily.
It's a good change of the topic, but what we're going back to is the trade that occurred between the Montreal Canadiens and the Dallas Stars last night.
Yep.
Montreal trades Eric Cole to Dallas. In exchange, they acquire Michael Ryder back to Montreal after a five-year absence and a third-round draft pick. Sort of an interesting trade from both perspectives.
Yep.
And the only part of the trade that I really don't like is the fact that Dallas threw in a third-round pick in addition. You know, Ryder's a UFA after this season. Eric Cole's got 2 years left on his contract. Let me throw it to you guys to start. Your thoughts on the deal?
Well, first off, I love it because this is the first real trade of the year, it seems like. It's not Alexei Ponikarovsky for a seventh-round draft pick. It's actually a good player for a good player. But, you know, Drew, it is an interesting trade because Michael Ryder has been very good for Dallas early on this season. I mean, it's not so early anymore, but, you know, 17, 18 games into the year, Michael Ryder's been a big part of the team, and he's getting big minutes. And Eric Cole, on the other hand, has struggled. And Eric Cole was good last year, if you remember, on that line with David Desharnais and Max Pacioretty. But this year, he just hasn't been going. And I know Richie is going to, you know, agree with me on this one. And it's a situation where you have a guy who's got 2 years left on his contract at, I believe, $8 or $9 million in Eric Cole versus Michael Ryder, who's going to be a UFA. And you mentioned throwing in the draft pick, and that might be because of the fact they're taking on the salary. But Dallas, if I'm not mistaken, is a little bit under the salary cap going into next year, and that's why they've taken on the salary. But
they have a ton of salary cap. They have $11 million in cap space.
There you go. And so they pick up a bit of salary. But as far as the two players go, I mean, both guys are snipers. Both guys have scored 30 goals in the NHL before, and I like both guys. And if you remember, Michael Ryder, the year that the Boston Bruins won the Stanley Cup, Michael Ryder was kind of a support guy who got lots of key goals, a big body, not the best skater, but he can put the puck in the net, whereas Eric Cole is a much more physical guy. He's the type of guy you dump the puck in, he's big, 6'3", and he'll come out with the puck. And you remember when the Carolina Hurricanes won the Stanley Cup in 06, he was a force to be reckoned with, causing all types of problems. So, I mean, this trade, I look at it and I say, okay, Cole's struggling, and if you're Dallas, why are you trading Ryder? Well, you hope that Cole gives you more physicality and you also pick up the salary. But for me, it's kind of a trade that works for both teams.
Richie?
Yeah, I can see Ezzy's point in terms of it working for both teams. I guess I do like it a little bit more for Montreal than I do for Dallas, but I think this trade needs to be broken down in terms of talent and then salary cap.
Yep.
I think we should try and break it down in those two.
Yep.
Compartmentalize it that way. So I think what you have there is you have, talent-wise, you have a guy like Eric Cole who's more of an up-and-down kind of player. Good skater, can stick handle, more of a shooter than a passer, can be aggressive. Maybe he's not as aggressive as he was way back in the day because of the surgeries he's had, but still aggressive, goes to the net. Not great player on the power play, and more of a five-on-five kind of guy.
Yep. Whereas Ryder is.
You have Michael Ryder who's, you know, not going to be not the fastest guy, not the most physical guy, but a great wrist shot.
Mm-hmm.
Great wrist shot. And he goes into the open areas. He's a scorer. He finds open areas and goes to open areas. So when you look at it in terms of talent, well, Ryder fits in really well with the Habs. You know, you have Plekanec, you have Desharnais, and what you have is centers who like to pass the puck.
Yes.
And what you don't have is Cole isn't really a catch-and-shoot guy. He needs kind of the puck on his stick to create. And Ryder is a catch-and-shoot guy. So when you have a lot of passers, a catch-and-shoot guy like Ryder fits really well. Also with Ryder, you have a guy who's familiar with Montreal, familiar with the pressures from the Maritimes, familiar with Michel Therrien. You really don't have the adjustment period that you usually have. Now, looking at Dallas, you have Eric Cole, If you watched Dallas play earlier this year, what happened with Ryder is he kind of slid down to the third line wing spot. He was kind of a tweener because he had Jágr on the first line, and you had Louis Eriksson, and you had Ray Whitney when he's healthy. And so what happened was there wasn't really a spot for Ryder in those top two lines if everybody was healthy. And so he was kind of playing a tweener role, and he's not a physical guy, and he's more of a scorer. So if he's not scoring for you, he's not doing a ton. Whereas for Cole can play that tweener role a little bit better. So to me, it does make sense for Dallas, but I do like it a little bit more for Montreal. The draft pick I'm not so sure about, but it's only a third-round pick. Money-wise, the Eric Cole contract is far more of an issue to me.
$4.5 million for the next 2 years. So
after this year.
So Eric Cole is pretty much on the books for the Dallas Stars for the next after this year for 2 years at $9 million.
And you can go back to the tape. I'm sure Remus can pull it up the day he signed because I didn't like the contract. And I'm sure there's some tape of that.
He signed the 4 year deal 2 summers ago.
4 years, $18 million. Yeah.
And so you're getting rid of that contract. And it gives you more salary cap flexibility, which you will need in Montreal. They obviously spend more money. They may re-sign Ryder. But what also happens is this. A player of Eric Cole's style of play is more apt to break down. So you don't only have 2 more years. You have 2 more years, to me, on a player that is less likely to be as productive for the duration of his contract. And that's why I could see it being an issue for Dallas down the road.
He's 34 years old right now, so he's still got... he's still got three. He'll be 37 at the end of the contract.
But it's the way he plays. He's a power forward. Yes,
and if you think about that, Richie, this is why you're the lead analyst, because you just enlightened me to another point. I mean, if you think about it, the risk-reward here, you've got the reward for the Montreal Canadiens is, okay, Michael Ryder plays well. You can re-sign him to 1 or 2 years, and you're not going to re-sign him for $4.5 million. You'll probably sign him to, what, $2 million a year, league average around there. But with Eric Cole, with the Dallas Stars, if he doesn't quite work out... Okay. Then they've still got a guy that they can plug in, and if he doesn't work out, which the Montreal Canadiens, by the way, I know this has been blown a little bit out of proportion, but with Eric Cole's comments about how he was didn't want to play anymore, and he was thinking about retiring. I mean, that's kind of difficult when you have 2 years left on your contract and you signed a 4 year deal only 2 years ago. But really, there's an element of that. I think he did fall out of favor, and he wasn't playing well. And you're thinking, okay, Michael Ryder, he's a guy we're familiar with. Let's bring him here. We know what he can do. He's playing well with Dallas. And he's a UFA. So if we want to re-sign him, that's an option too. So it's really, this is a pretty strategic move. This is a trade that, this was something that I don't think it caught everybody off surprise in the sense that this is the Joe Thornton trade. But it was a little off by surprise by me because Michael Ryder has been very good for Dallas over the last couple of years. But Montreal sees something that they don't like in Cole, and then they like in Ryder.
The thing I like from the Dallas perspective is you're going to lose a guy probably in the offseason, and the worst thing you can do with an asset is lose him for nothing. So you do get somebody. Granted, you're taking a bit of a risk in acquiring Eric Cole, but Eric Cole is familiar with Ray Whitney.
Yep.
They do have their time together in Carolina.
Yep.
And Mark Recchi is also in that front office, and he's familiar with Eric Cole from Carolina as well. So there is a little bit of a familiarity there. Taking a little bit of a risk money-wise, but Dallas is not up against the salary cap, so that really shouldn't be the
issue. In
fact,
they want that salary.
They probably don't mind having that salary in terms of making sure that they're nowhere near the floor or anything. But it's not like something that's going to hamstring them from doing something else with another player down the road. But I do understand there is a risk involved. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. When we come back, Brad Treliving, the Vice President of Hockey Operations and the Assistant General Managers of the Phoenix Coyotes, joins us. Back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Plus, from the other side of the boardroom door, this is Inside the Front Office.
Inside the Front Office this Wednesday evening with Brad Treliving, the Vice President of Hockey Operations and the Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes. Brad, good evening, and thank you very much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Brad, in the course of day-to-day life, those of us in this room and you know, the people, our audience, you know, all have a boss that they answer to. There's either, you know, a general manager or a manager and an owner of a company. You know, the Coyotes, of course, are in that, you know, interesting predicament with their ownership situation. So, you know, the first question, you know, who do you and Don Maloney answer to on a daily or a weekly basis in terms of when you have to go to ownership?
Well, I think, obviously our ownership situation has been well documented. But really, at the end of the day, it's really not unlike the traditional ownership or as any of the team's hierarchy is set up. The gentleman from the NHL, Bill Daly, is really our contact. And I wouldn't say it's a daily contact. Obviously, as we get into the spring each year, for the last number of years that they've been owning us, we would sit down with Bill, go through a budget, and go through the typical budgeting process that any team would go through. And at that time, we go out and run our team the way any other team would run their team and make decisions and those types of things. And then as we need to get approval for a different process, whether it be a contract signing or a different roster move, obviously we stay in very close communication with Bill and make sure that he signs off on any of the transactions. But, you know, for the most part, I can honestly say, they've been tremendous to deal with. We have a budget. We're not able to go over it, but it allows us to put a competitive product on the ice. And then, as I said, as things happen or as we would normally need a approval process for any transaction you're going to do, we do that through Bill, and they've been great to deal with.
Brad, if you had to pick one, would you say your team is built to Dave Tippett's coaching style, or that Dave Tippett coaches according to the type of players that you guys bring in?
That's a good question. I think any coach, you know, initially I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense to go in there and say you're going to have a specific style when you don't have the type of players to fit that style. So, you know, obviously when Dave came to us, I think it was well known and people around the league know, you know, his teams play with a great deal of structure. I think he's a tremendous teacher of the game. The teams play with a lot of discipline. I think we've, over the course of the last number of years, have formed a real identity to our team. And I think his style or his philosophy is based a lot of around the players that we do have. And then as we go forward here, you know, we continue to find players that we feel fit with us. We do play a certain style, and there's certain things that are priorities for, you know, the organization and for the coaching staff. And, you know, our job on the management side is to find people that fit that type of style. And, we're always looking to add more talent and more skill, and I think you need talent and skill to win in this league. But at the end of the day, too, I think you form that identity and you try to, you know, have some continuity with the player personality you bring in to match the style of play that you play.
You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Brad Treliving. He's the Vice President of Hockey Operations and the Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes.
Brad, Dave Tippett gets a lot of attention, and rightly so. He's an excellent hockey coach, but you've got a pretty decent, excellent assistant coach in Dave King there. We're obviously all in this room big fans of his. What are his day-to-day responsibilities, and how often do you talk hockey theory with Dave King? Because he's obviously got a load of NHL and international hockey experience.
Yeah, I'm fortunate that I deal with Dave, daily. And I think he hit the nail. I don't know if there's many more experienced hockey people than Kinger. I mean, he's just a wealth of knowledge. He's seen it at all levels, from the junior level going back to when he coached, at that level, internationally, the NHL. So Dave he's been a tremendous asset to the organization. And really his responsibility, you know, for 2 years, Dave was part of the coaching staff, the day-to-day coaching staff. He's just the coach on the team. And then last year we moved Dave into a development coach role where he spends a lot of time with our minor league team. I oversee the minor league team in Portland, but Kinger's down there a lot. He's on the ice with the coaches, with the players. He goes out and sees our prospects and spends time with not only them, but the coaches that they're playing for. And then, you know, as we got into the playoffs last year, Dave's a real resource to the coaching staff, Chip and the rest of the coaches, in terms of breaking down opponents. And that portion has evolved this year as well. As you know, we looked at it coming out of the lockout and with a shortened season, and Kinger went through this in Calgary, I think it was in 92, 93, 94, and just had some ideas of different wrinkles you can look at in terms of the shortened season. And so we have Dave doing a lot of pre-scouting, a lot of, you know, breaking down video, breaking down other teams, special teams, their five-on-five play. But, again, you know, you mentioned it was a neat comment. I find myself daily having long conversations with Kinger, not only about our team, our prospects, but, you know, the game in general. And I think that's more than anything where Kinger's such an interesting guy. He's got great insight, great ideas. He's really seen the evolution of the game in different facets, and as you said, seen it from all sides, internationally and here in North America. So he's been just a tremendous asset to our organization.
You're listening to TSN 1290. We're talking to Brad Treliving, the Vice President of Hockey Operations and Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes. Brad, this offseason you brought back a couple of former Coyotes in Zibanek Mihalik and Matthew Lombardi. These are two guys who, you know, sort of struggled when in their other situations since they left Phoenix. Why do you think these players tend to have more success with the Coyotes organization than with other organizations?
That's a good question. I mean, we've seen it, and I think it's not necessarily unique to us. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of stories throughout the league where you just see players fit in certain areas. Radim Verbat is another player who was with us, you know, a number of years ago, got a great offer to leave in free agency. He went to Tampa Bay. It didn't work out. We ended up bringing him back. He's been a, you know, he's been a 30-plus goal scorer for us. I think there's, you know, a lot of what our team's built around is fit and chemistry. We're not a team that's, you know, just from a budget standpoint, we're not able to go out and be, you know, making a big splash in free agency in terms of the high-dollar free agent signings. And so we've got to try to find value wherever we can. And a large portion of that is clearly identifying roles for players and then finding the specific players to fit those roles. And I think in, you know, the cases that you've just brought up with Z and Matthew Lombardi, they had specific roles. And I think in both, you know, we've unfortunately lost a lot of players over the years. You know, a lot to do with our ownership situation and a lot of the uncertainty around our ownership situation. And then, you know, the other part is just not being able to meet some of the offers that the players have gotten out there. But we find that, you know, we're able to bring guys back at a good value, and they really fit into a specific role with our team. They fit with our culture. They fit inside our dressing room. And we've had to get a lot of mileage out of just that, you know, fitting the character and the personalities. You know, and our group is really the old adage of the, you know, the whole being greater than some of the parts. That's really how we operate. And in both those cases, they've come in. They're players that we had a history with. And both players, quite frankly, are guys that, you know, over the all the players that we've lost over the years, those are two guys we really didn't want to lose. We just really felt they fit with us, and we're glad to have both of them back.
Brad, you work with Don Maloney on a daily basis. What would you say is his biggest strength as a general manager?
I think Don's one of the best in the business here. Obviously, having a chance to work with him on a day-to-day basis, and I think a couple of things. You know, as I said a little earlier, just really, you know, the value he's able to get in terms of, you know, finding the right piece to fit in the right hole at the right number, and just the patience that Don shows. You know, he's, you know, we've been through a lot of things here in Phoenix, and I don't know when our ownership situation first became public, and you know, we went through a bankruptcy. You know, ultimately it was Don's steady hand at the wheel, if you will, that that kept everything just moving forward. And you know, he from day one has just, you know, whether it be the front office, whether it be the, you know, the training staff, the players, you know, his comment has always been, you know, all we can let these distractions bury us, or we can allow them just to take care of themselves. Ultimately, it's beyond any of our control. But what we can focus on and what we do have control on is how we play, how we prepare, how we build our team. And looking after the job at hand on the ice is only going to help us, you know, hopefully stay in a place that everybody wants to stay in, and let the off-ice stuff take care of itself. So, you know, he's just been a real steady guiding hand through this, you know, not only all the things that have gone on over the 4 years, but, you know, the success of the team really, I think, is a direct result of the work of Don.
Brad Treliving is our guest here on NHL Midweek. You're listening to TSN 1290.
Brad, you know, a lot of hockey fans will picture GMs and assistant general managers as, you know, just sitting in the press box and, you know, traveling around and just, you know, pulling the trigger on deals on a daily basis. But obviously you guys talk to players. How often do you talk to your players, and what are you talking to your players about, you know, whether it be just talking about the last game or if it's, you know, serious hockey talk?
Well, there's a lot of that sitting. There's a lot of profanity sitting in the press box.
That's what I thought.
Don't discount that. There is a lot of that. But, no, I think it's important that you know, I think all of us have a pretty good sense of, you know, you get to know players by watching them and you know, seeing what their strengths and weaknesses are of players. But in order to really build a team, I think you – and, again, I speak to our situation. It is a little bit unique. But I think you really have to – you know, have a handle on the individual. And, you know, you look at the league today and everything is so close, you know, everything is so tight that you really do feel that chemistry and mix and sort of the makeup of your group and how well they get along and, you know, how quickly you can build that team, because that is a difficult process. And I think the better you know the individual, the better chance you're going to have success. So I think we spend a lot of times, you know, For me, obviously, I'm around our team, you know, a bit, but I'm around our minor league team a lot to get to know, you know, those players and you know, the skill set and what you see on the ice, to me, is that's sort of the cover of the book. You know, you have to dig inside and find out what the player is made of and what type of personality and what makes them tick. And so there's a lot of that goes into it. You know, you go as far back as your prospects, the kids that you've drafted. You know, that process starts early as you're trying to identify those players and sort through the upcoming drafts and you know, the character and the, you know, really trying to find the DNA of the players that are out there. So I think it's a really important part of the job.
Brad, when you're entering a negotiation with a potential free agent or a potential free agent acquisition, do you, you know, so is it sort of been your policy to proactively address the ownership uncertainty, or is it something that you sort of only answer the question if it comes about from the player or his agent?
Well, it's been pretty public, so we can't, you know, we can't hide from it.
Right.
And like I said, hey, you know, we've been in situations where we've had, you know, both sides of it. We've had our own pending free agents, you know, two of them you spoke about. You know, if you ask Mihailuk and Lombardi both, neither one of them wanted to leave Phoenix. And there's a number of guys that were in that boat. A lot of players, once they've been there, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the success the teams have the last few years. But, you know, it's a great lifestyle. They love the coaching staff. The families love the area to live in. But obviously the uncertainty and what, you know, when you get to that, when you've earned that right to get to free agency, you know, people want to know that if they sign somewhere for 2, 3, 4 years that they're going to be there and, you know, that the team's not going somewhere else. So, but at the end of the day, we can't run from it. So, you know, whether it be our own free agents that we're looking to re-sign or, you know, in when we get into July 1 and get into the market, you know, we're very open and honest and just say, here's where the situation is at. And in a lot of cases, quite frankly, guys, we know as much as a lot of the general public out there does. You know, we, you know, it's gone on for a long time. We still, believe that, and I guess we've got the inside knowledge, knowing how hard the league has worked to keep the team here, that we firmly believe the team will be there. But, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to be honest with the player and say, here's where the situation is at. And, you know, we've gone through this for a number of years. But ultimately, until the ownership situation is solved, finalized, and somebody says, you know, we're here for the, you know, we're here for the long haul, that's going to be an issue. So, you know, we've been able to attract some players, and ultimately, you know, the guys that we've gone for, entered into contracts with, are those that we feel fit a specific need for us, and have all, you know, for the most part, they've all come in and contributed and fit in real nice.
Brad Treliving, the Vice President of Hockey Operations and the Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes, thank you very much for joining us this week on the NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Just some tremendous insight into the inner workings of the Coyotes organization.
You bet, guys. Anytime.
Thanks, Brad. Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Big thank you to Brad Treliving, Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes, for that great insight into the organization. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download via the tsn1290.ca website, as well via the illegalcurve.com website. Or you can just save yourself the hassle and subscribe to the show on iTunes and get it sent to you each and every week. Going to spend some time talking about the Washington Capitals power play. This is Break It Down.
Break It Down.
Washington Capitals power play, even though they are currently down 2-0 to the Philadelphia Flyers, has been very, very successful as of late. They're going to be in Winnipeg on Saturday to play the Jets, first time since an early season matchup. Figured we'd spend some time discussing the Caps power play. They have a five-man group that, you know, you put out their first unit, and their first unit on the power play is really, it's a who's who of offensive talent there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start Nicholas Backstrom, Alex Ovechkin, Mike Ribeiro, Troy Brower, Mike Green. It's a lot of offensive power on to be on your first power play, so it should be of no surprise that they're playing so well. Richie, why don't you describe how they set up initially and how they sort of run their power play?
Well, it's becoming more common, Drew. We've talked about it with Jack Edwards of Nesson, the Boston Bruins play-by-play man.
Yeah.
And we've broken down the Tampa Bay power play. The Washington Capitals essentially run a 1-3-1. And how they set that up is they have Mike Green at the top of the point. And then they have, the three in a row would be Alex Ovechkin on the left side. In the middle, you have Troy Brower in the high slot. And on the right side, you have Mike Ribeiro. And as the 1-3-1 has to basically work, you need to have Ribeiro and Ovechkin both be on their off-wings, which they are. And by off-wings, what I mean is, if Ribeiro's on the right side, he has a left-handed shot, okay? And that's what I mean by Ovechkin, is on the left side with a right-handed shot. Similar to St. Louis in Tampa, with a left-handed shot on the right side, if you follow, and Purcell or Stamkos on their off-wing. And so...
By being on their off wing, when they step into a shot, they're shooting from a better angle, from a better goal scorer's angle at that point than if they were on their correct wing, which would mean that the puck would really be coming off their stick further away from the net almost.
And it's essentially impossible to one time unless you're streaking towards the net.
That's right.
Okay.
So let me just interrupt quickly. Power play percentage for the Caps right now, second in the NHL, 28.6% success rate.
And you're going to be seeing them this weekend on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And when you look at the rest of the power play, you have Nicholas Backstrom. And Backstrom will play on the goal line on the right side for the most part, which is also essentially... It would be considered, I guess, as off-wing to a point. And then you have Backstrom will go towards the net, in front of the net, when the puck goes to the blue line. So it's hard to contain this power play, and you watch film of this power play, and you say, okay, where do you go to stop it? Because the power play essentially, Drew, flows through Mike Ribeiro, similar to how the power play in Tampa Bay flows through Marty St. Louis. He's a great passer, Ribeiro. He's a little, he tries some things he probably shouldn't be trying. But he's a great passer, and what happens is he has options, right? He has Brower in the high slot for a one-timer. He has Ovechkin on the far side for a one-timer or to cut in back door. Or he's got Ribeiro for a one-timer because they're all three right-handed shooting players. Or he can dish it down to Backstrom, and Backstrom can either pass it to Brower, crash the net himself, or pass it to Ovechkin or go all the way back to the point, which is more rare. You have so many options. So the question then, if you're the Jets or any other team, is who do you stop?
Pick your poison, almost?
It's a pick your poison option, really, here. So when the puck goes to Ovechkin, lots of times people think he's going to shoot, but he may make a pass, and they've scored off some of those passes. So do you take away the Ovechkin pass? Well, you almost have to because of his shot. And you know Ribeiro won't shoot, but if you give Ribeiro too much space, he's such a great passer. And then you have Backstrom, who sometimes will rotate with Ribeiro on that half boards. He's also a great passer. And Green's got a great shot, and Brouwer can shoot. It's almost an impossible power play to really cut down on. So I would say one thing you probably want to do if you're the Jets or anybody else is Mike Ribeiro's soft. He turns away from contact, and he weighs about 110 pounds. So what I think you want to do is engage him in contact, and you want to engage him right away, and you want to take away space. And I think if you do that with your top left, with your top forward, I think you pressure the team to make quicker decisions. Now, that will kill you at times, but if you give those guys time on the Washington power play, you're in trouble. And of course, the first issue is taking penalties, but penalties in every game. So you need to me, take away the time and space of Ribeiro to be able to take away the proficiency of this power play.
I think you're right, Richie, and it's funny how the top two power plays in the NHL right now happen to both be in the Southeast Division. Not the best thing for the Jets. But, you know, you mentioned the 1-3-1 and Ribeiro and all the weapons that they have. And Washington, for years, especially when they were going and Ovechkin was in his 90-point days, so I guess we're going back 3 or 4 years, didn't have the best power play, even though Mike Green was up there leading the league in power play goals. It was almost a situation where, who's going to get the puck? There's too many guys and there's only one puck. But I think you're right. You're not, you know, everyone remembers that Tampa Bay game a few weeks back. It might have been 3 weeks back now, where the Jets lost 8-3 and Tampa Bay seemed to be scoring at will. With the Washington Capitals, I don't think you're going to be able to contain everybody. And I think the Jets have struggled to find the right guys. You know, they've given James Wright some PK time. Slater's always going to be out there because he's good with the faceoffs. And, you know, they've struggled with guys, you know, Ladd and Little are mainstays, but they've given Kane some opportunities. But I think, you know, Richie nailed it with Ribeiro. But it's also, you know, that in this role, you're going to have your shutdown guys. But really, this is the type of situation where I think a guy like Evander Kane would be some personnel that you'd like to have for his ability to, for essentially his speed and his ability to turn a block shot into a scoring opportunity,
which we saw on Sunday against the Devils when he blocked the shot at the blue line.
Right.
And one of the things that we mentioned in preparing for this is the Capitals are very susceptible to a goal against, so to a shorthanded goal. Why is that? And quickly, we're sort of up against that.
Yeah, Ovechkin will like to wander off the line because it's 1-3-1, so he's playing lower. So Ovechkin likes to wander, obviously, and so you really only have one guy back at the point. Mike Green isn't exactly the most defensively conscious defenseman. In reality, he's not. He wanders a lot. And so what happens is you lose focus for a second, and you can turn it the other way. So a guy like Kane can really do something against this team. A lot of penalty killers who are offensively proficient can do something against this power play if they're fortunate enough to be able to touch the puck.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 1 hour down, you're listening to TSN 1290. Down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Yes, Richard, another witticism?
I think we need to get Remus some kind of new saying other than the expert that he is. I think that's Tim's saying.
Yeah, Tim's the expert. Tim.
Okay, is Remus the amateur that he is?
No.
How about we say with producer Remus on loan from Rick Ralph and the TSN roundtable? How about that?
What about Rick Ralph playing goal for the Carl's hockey team? Remus brought Rick Ralph in and they picked up the W.
That really happened?
Yeah.
That's the first time I've heard of it.
You didn't know that, Drew?
Rick Ralph can strap on the pads and stop the puck, I'll tell you that much.
I can't believe Rick Ralph wanted to be seen in public with you guys outside of really the show.
He wore a mask underneath the hockey mask.
Anyway, you'll tell me that story in a little while. Anyways, you can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
Six things we learned this week. We start with Ezra Ginsberg, who has some positive things to say about one Tyler Bozak.
I do, and I have also a positive thing to say about, this is a great thing about live radio, Fraser McLaren, who went to Kelvin High School. I went to Kelvin High School. Good Winnipeg boy just scored a goal for the Toronto Maple Leafs. 1-0.
That's where the similarities begin and end.
That's not my thing, but I thought I'd give my boy McLaren a shout-out. Tyler Bozak, he's, right now, I feel, is the best bargain in the NHL. He's making $1.5 million. He's top 15. I'm not sure exactly what because it changes on a nightly basis, but he's about 56% in the faceoff circle. Very good defensive zone faceoff guy. But Tyler Bozak right now is playing first-line center for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and, you know, everyone looks at Tyler Bozak and you know doesn't maybe jump out as a superstar NHLer, and, you know, he had his best season last year, 60 points. And granted, on most teams, maybe Tyler Bozak wouldn't be a first-line center. But Tyler Bozak, in my opinion, is a guy that the Toronto Maple Leafs should consider re-signing. He's going to be a UFA. He's 26 years old. We all know that a guy, Getzlaff, is another Saskatchewan boy, is somebody that the Toronto Maple Leafs covet, Richie. But Tyler Bozak, I think, you know, we've seen him play here a couple of times now. I really like his game. He's a good skater, a guy that played University of Denver, and I think he's filling that role for the Toronto Maple Leafs really nicely, and Phil Kessel likes playing off of him. He's a faster guy that Bozak can feed, and I really think that Tyler Bozak has to be given credit for what he's giving the Leafs, and making less than the league average. So I really like his game, and I think the Leafs should consider re-signing him, even if it's for a second-line center role.
I have to agree with Ezzy. I've always liked Bozak's game, Ezzy. I agree. He's added that face-off element.
Yep.
He's a good skater, and he's a good passer. I like his game, and I'm happy to see his emergence.
Five.
Richard Pollock, Bob Hartley is allowing Jay Bouwmeester to play a style that suits his game a lot better than the Sutter brothers did.
He is, Drew. He's allowing Jay Bouwmeester to kind of play a little bit more of a natural game, less rigid in terms of the structure. He's allowing him to jump into the play. I think it plays to Bouwmeester's strength. I think if he kind of reminds me of Niedermeyer when he can jump in the play and then jump back so quickly because he's such a good skater, and he's bigger than Scott Niedermeyer, so his stride's longer. I think he's been playing really well, and I think it's nice to have him. You know, sometimes what you see is players get pigeonholed, and he's had a bad rap, you know, hasn't played in the playoffs and all that that goes along with it. Okay, fine, sure. But you know what? His strength is his skating, puck movement, and a kind of effortless play, and I think that he's finding his game in Calgary now, and he seems to be far more confident.
And quickly, I think more people should be talking about the fact that he's played 608 consecutive games. Yeah. He's getting up there with the greatest streak of all time. Henrik Sedin's not far behind him, but I think people should start talking about him in that almost Cal Ripken type of Ironman streak. Not, you know, Cal Ripken, that's a big-time name right there, but come on, 605 games or whatever it is? It's ridiculous.
In the NHL, it's tremendous accomplishment.
Four.
Back to Ezra Ginsberg. Chris Kunitz does not get enough attention for what he brings to the Pittsburgh Penguins.
I don't know if you guys have caught on to the Saskatchewan theme here, the Regina-Saskatchewan theme, Bozak and Kunitz, both from Regina. But, you know, Pittsburgh was in Winnipeg recently, and I love Chris Kunitz. And I think of people think of Sidney Crosby and who he plays with, Chris Kunitz, Pascal Dupuis flanking him on the wings there. But Chris Kunitz, I don't think gets enough credit for really how good of a hockey player he is. And he was pretty good on Anaheim, too, and Pittsburgh brought him over. And he's a huge part of that team. Chris Kunitz is another guy, if you watch him play, he's physical. He does a lot of things for Crosby. Crosby opens up the ice for Chris Kunitz, but I think Chris Kunitz also opens up the ice for Crosby because, as we know, Crosby's not the most physical guy. But Chris Kunitz plays the body checks. And, you know, Chris Kunitz, I think, should be given more credit. When you think of the Pittsburgh Penguins and you talk about the big two of Malkin, Crosby, Malkin's obviously injured, and then you go down the lineup, sure, James Neal and Chris Letang and, you know, back in the day, Jordan Staal, now Brandon Sutter. But I think Chris Kunitz on his own now should be given a lot of credit for how good of a hockey player he is and not just, you know, being given credit for the fact that he's on Sidney Crosby's line. And by the way, he's been on Sidney Crosby's line for a long time now, and nobody is replacing him in that role. And that the reason is because Crosby loves playing with him, and night in, night out, he's a consistent player.
Three.
Richard Pollock, a team we're going to be talking some more about in about 8 minutes' time with Dan Wood. The Anaheim Ducks are a team that allows its star players to flourish and experiment as opposed to playing a strict system, thereby limiting offensive creativity.
You don't see this much anymore, Drew, and part of that's due to the fact that they have the star power, Bobby Ryan, Ryan Getzlaff, Corey Perry, Teemu Selanne. But these players are allowed to be skillful. There's no get it over and dump it in. Try something. Try a play, whether it be in the neutral zone, whether it be in the offensive zone. And I think a lot of that credit goes to Bruce Boudreau, and not that they didn't have creativity with Randy Carlyle, because they did. But Bruce Boudreau has also really allowed them to flourish, I think. And, you know, he's playing to the talent he's had, and you know, you'll hear him, you've heard this week, excuse me, him being criticized by Troy Brower, whoever it was, saying, you know, there was no structure in Washington, blah, blah, blah. Well, I mean, they haven't done any better without him. And I think what you see in Anaheim is him saying, okay, you know, what are my strengths? My strengths, I got stars here, and I got forward stars. So let's make sure we take care of the back end, as Bob Murray has, you know, signing some bigger guys and having some puck movers back there. And let's work to the strength. Let's have a great power play, and let's allow the good players to try things and not just dump it in and drop a couple guys back and be a neutral zone squad. They create a lot of plays from puck movement and stick handling through the neutral zone and in the offensive zone, and it's really, really fun to watch.
This might be a bit of a controversial one, Ezzy. The NHL Department of Player Safety got it right by not suspending Canadiens forward Max Pacioretty for his hit last Saturday on Rangers defenseman Ryan McDonagh, and the ruling, or lack thereof, sets right. A good precedent moving forward.
Ryan McDonagh didn't play for the Rangers last night, as everybody knows, against the Winnipeg Jets. And Ryan McDonagh is a fantastic defenseman. He's turned into one of the better shot blockers and shutdown defensemen. Everyone remembers how good he was last year. But, you know, anybody who watches TSN on a nightly basis has seen Craig Button on That's Hockey Tonight, and he's broken down guys turning into hits. And this is why I think, you know, this is important. Because body checking, as I've said time and time again, just like fighting, has a place in hockey. And body checking can turn a game around. I mean, that's why you have third and fourth line guys and grinders and shutdown lines, because body checking is an important part. And on that hit, and it's, I think it's important that that hit, and the NHL Department of Player Safety and Shanny decided not to suspend him, because it's clear that Ryan McDonagh braced himself and turned into the hit. And I think you're starting to see this more and more and more. And the speed in the NHL is, it almost seems like each year it gets faster and faster and faster. And I think it's important, because you have to learn not only how to give a hit, but you have to learn how to take a hit. And a player can be just as responsible for causing an injury to himself as is the player who does it. And I think that if you take a hit, and by the way, the boards have a give to them. So if you can still have a, you know, take a pretty good hit and not end up with an injury. So I think, you know, breaking down that hit, and as we've talked about before, these hits are overanalyzed and they watch them 400 times. I think it's really important, because, you know, a hit from behind isn't a hit from behind if the guy turns into it and makes it a hit from behind. So I think that's why it sets, you know, a pretty good precedent.
I'm with Ezzy on the fact that a lot of players turn into hits now, and they're kind of bringing that upon themselves. I really do think that you watch players, and there's a guy lining up a guy for a shoulder check, and he turns in, he knows he's going to get a penalty, and that responsibility should fall partially, most of that should fall, that responsibility should fall on the hitty, not the hitter.
Wrapping up six things, Richard Pollock, Johnny Oduya, and Nicholas Chalmerson are flourishing as the second pairing combination with the Chicago Blackhawks, a team, for the record, you predicted wasn't going to make the playoffs.
Yeah, you're going to keep mentioning that. I know. Well, I'll live with that. You know, Drew, you know, I'm not moving away from it. I'm not shying away from the fact that
you're wearing your shame.
Hey, yeah, Richie, also hold on. Before you get into yours, I'll save you right now. I had both the Montreal Canadiens and the Anaheim Ducks in the playoffs. They're both in first place now. So, hey, even the best-looking ones make mistakes.
Oh, yeah. I got nothing on that one. Go ahead.
You know, Johnny Oduya, obviously familiar to the Winnipeg fans, but he's a nice, him and Nicholas Chalmerson, obviously both Swedish, and maybe there's a connection there, but I think it's the combination of Chalmerson being a stay-at-home guy, being very physical, and making the simple play. And Oduya likes to make it a little more complicated at times, and is a pretty quick skater, and can move the puck pretty well, and has some pretty solid attributes, and obviously his game got picked apart here, and there are shortcomings to his game, but credit where credit is due, and he's really flourished in Chicago, and obviously that's partially due to the fact that a guy like Duncan Keith can really shoulder a lot of the responsibility, but he's quietly played there, and under probably a lot less of a microscope than here, and he's flourished, and I think credit needs to be given to him, and I think Chalmerson's reemergence as a really solid top four defenseman. I guess the question is, and I don't know the answer to this right now, but the question is, has Chalmerson's reemergence brought Oduya to the next level, or has Oduya brought Chalmerson, allowed him to reemerge, excuse me? And it's a question that I think is worth examining.
It's one we'll have to keep our eyes on as the season progresses. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. And when we come back, Dan Wood, the Anaheim Ducks color analyst, is going to join us. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome to NHL Midweek Dan Wood. He's the Anaheim Ducks color commentator on 830 KLAA. Dan, good evening. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thank you.
Dan, we have to start with obviously one of the bigger changes in the Ducks since, say, this time last year is the difference between Randy Carlyle and Bruce Boudreau. If you had to pinpoint one specific item, what do you think the biggest difference between the two of them as head coaches is?
Well, I guess the most obvious difference is just, Bruce is a real people person. He has the nickname Gabby for a reason. And, Randy's personality is quite different than that. I think they're both good hockey coaches, but that's the obvious one. And then the other one, for whatever reason, with the notable exception of the Stanley Cup year, Randy Carlyle's teams in Anaheim got off to slow starts, typically. And Bruce Boudreau's teams typically get off to really good starts. That happened in Washington, and it's happened this year here. So those are the two things that would strike me.
Dan, we were talking about Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry earlier in the show, and they're obviously pending UFAs. Have those players and the fact that they're pending unrestricted free agents, has that been a distraction at all to the Anaheim Ducks?
I really don't think it has. I haven't heard anything or seen anything to suggest that, with the possible exception of Corey Perry getting off to a rather slow start offensively. He's begun to pick it up here lately. It could conceivably be affecting Corey Perry. But as far as the team goes, I don't think so. It's funny. This topic really only comes up when I do radio interviews from elsewhere around the U.S. and Canada. In Anaheim, it's not really that big of a topic, so I think it will get to be one here if we get closer to the trade deadline and those guys haven't signed, because obviously the Ducks could be in a really tough spot. If they're looking like they're headed for the playoffs and those guys aren't signed, what do you do? I don't think you can let it get to the point where they can walk away and you get nothing. So it would be a difficult challenge for General Manager Bob Murray. But I think either he gets one or both signed, or he deals one or both.
Dan, watching the Ducks, I mean, Teemu Selänne is a player that just does not seem to age. Obviously, you have a first-hand look at him all the time. What is the key to his seemingly never-ending success?
That's a great question, and I think if I could give you the answer, there'd be an awful lot of hockey players that would take heed. Teemu, he does take really good care of himself. I mean, I think he's blessed genetically to begin with. But on top of that, he really does the right things. I mean, I see him on the airplane. I see what he eats, what he doesn't eat. I know he does his best to get the proper rest and so on. So, I think he's has a gift to begin with, but unlike a lot of people, he has made the most of that gift.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Dan Wood. He's the Anaheim Ducks color commentator on 830 KLAA. Dan, speaking of veteran Finnish hockey players, many people thought that Saku Koivu was going to continue his slide in production. He looks reborn this season. Why is that? Why the resurgence in the career of Saku Koivu?
The only thing I can pinpoint there is Bruce Boudreau made the comment before the season that Saku Koivu was going to be this club's third-line center. And I wondered at the time, well, who's going to be the second line center? And they haven't really answered that question. They've floated different people in. Bobby Ryan, Nick Bonino, Peter Holland have all played in the middle on the second line. And they really haven't found the answer to that. But they've been committed to keeping Saku Koivu on the third line. And when I say that, I think primarily what we're talking about is ice time. You know, they realize that at 38, Saku's not going to be able to play big, big minutes, and they need more, or, you know, less is more type thing from him. Bruce Boudreau has remained true to that, and I think it's worked well for Koivu, who's played primarily on a line with Andrew Cogliano and Dan Winnick. And for whatever reason, those three guys really clicked from day one of training camp. So I think the main thing is they're not overplaying Koivu, and it's worked out well.
Dan, the Anaheim Ducks acquired Sheldon Soure and Brian Allen in the offseason. What have those two defensemen brought to the Anaheim Ducks? And also Ben Lovejoy, what has he brought since being acquired from the Pittsburgh Penguins?
Well, Ben Lovejoy brings a right-hand shot, which is something that the Ducks have very few of in their organization on defense. And he's been pretty steady. He's a pretty good skater. He's a good competitor. And he's been a nice addition to this club. Brian Allen got off to a bit of a slow start, but has picked up his play recently. He's a big veteran guy, blocks a lot of shots, you know, not going to do anything spectacular. But along with Sheldon Soure, Brian Allen brings size and grit and has made it more difficult for teams to play against the Ducks. That was really a problem last season. Sheldon Soure has been tremendous, much better, I think, than anyone would have envisioned. And particularly playing alongside Francois Beauchemin, those guys have become unquestionably the top D tandem on the Ducks. And they're tied for second in the league, both at plus 13, and have really fit well together. Beauchemin, I have to say, is playing the best hockey I've ever seen him play. And I think really has to be talked about right now as a potential Norris Trophy candidate. The guy has been remarkably good this season, offensively and defensively. Just a pleasure to watch, really.
And he, Dan, made the move over to the right side, which was an unselfish move, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point, because they tried that in the year after they won the Cup, when Scott Niedermeyer took his little sabbatical. They moved Beauchemin to the right side, and it didn't work out very well. And when I saw that in the beginning of training camp, I thought, uh-oh, we've got a problem here. But Beauchemin says it's not a big deal. He says he's comfortable there, and he certainly has looked it.
You know, Dan, watching the Ducks, it seems like Bruce Boudreau really likes to accelerate that D and allow them to not only join the rush, but also, you know, pressure down the boards when the Ducks have some in-zone pressure. Has that been the case? And if so, has that kind of led to a little bit more offense?
I think so. I think that's a good observation, and particularly when Cam Fowler is in the lineup. You know, he's the guy, the best skater among the D, certainly the most offensively gifted, with the obvious exception of Sheldon Soure's big shot. But, you know, the Ducks missed Cam for 8 games, and, you know, he's been back now for 2, and it really adds another nice dimension on that blue line core, just Cam's ability to skate. The other night, he goes to the net in overtime, draws a penalty against Colorado that led to Corey Perry's game-winning goal in overtime. So I think you're right, and I think as long as Cam Fowler's in the lineup, you see that even more.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Dan Wood. He's the Anaheim Ducks color analyst on 830 KLAA. Dan, Victor Fast has played just so tremendously well for the Ducks so far this season. He's already secured a 2-year contract extension. Coming into this year, what was the organization's expectation for Victor Fast?
The organization must have thought he was pretty good, obviously, because they went out and signed him. I know Bruce Boudreau freely admits he didn't have a clue about Victor Fast and has been more than pleasantly surprised with Victor Fast's play. Obviously, the scouting, the Ducks European scout, Jan Aki Danielson, was a big proponent of signing Victor Fast. And, you know, he's been tremendous. There's no two ways about it. And he's earned that contract. And I think it was a good move by the Ducks, because they got him at a reasonable price. And had he continued to play as well as he has thus far, gotten to the end of the season, he would have been an unrestricted free agent. So conceivably, the Ducks could have either lost him or wound up having to pay him a whole lot more.
Dan, you know, it's good that we have you on. We have to ask you about Brian Burke. The Anaheim Ducks have brought Brian Burke back as a scout. Do you know what his exact responsibilities are going to be, whether it's if he's going to be specifically a pro scout or amateur scout? Could you maybe give us a little bit of insight into Brian Burke's new role with the Ducks?
In Brian Burke's very own words, his responsibilities are whatever Bob Murray wants.
Okay.
And that could be a combination of pro scouting, amateur scouting. Berkey is actually with the club right now. He's still going to be based in Toronto, but he's out here for about a week and a half. He's going to go to Phoenix on the weekend when the Ducks play down there twice, Saturday and Monday. Then he's going to go watch the Ducks American League clubs, the Norfolk Admirals, and kind of familiarize himself with what's in the organization. And, you know, he talked to the media the other day, Brian Burke did, and said, you know, if Bob Murray wants me to go scout the OHL, I'll do that, basically whatever he needs. And certainly Brian Burke and Bob Murray go back a long time. They work together in Vancouver. They work together here. The guy calling the shots is the other guy now from what it used to be. But they have a real good relationship, and I think Berkey can help the Ducks and obviously, you know, staying in the game, remaining visible, remaining current with the league. That will help him in his endeavor to get back in a GM seat somewhere in the NHL.
Dan Wood, the Anaheim Ducks color analyst on 830 KLAA, thank you very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Have a good rest of the show.
You too. Thanks very much, Dan. Take care. Let's go to break. When we come back, Prospect Pulse. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca, and NHL Midweek. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Dan Wood. He's the Anaheim Ducks color analyst for having joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download both on TSN1290.ca and IllegalCurve.com. You can also just subscribe to our shows on iTunes and get each and every show, podcast, whatever else we do, sent to you that way. Yes, Richard?
We do an Illegal Curve game-winning goal pool
on
Twitter. There should be a prediction for when Remus plays a song that was put out before 1995, or after 1995.
I love it. Remus playing all the music from my childhood. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, I love it.
I played Avicii.
You played what? Jane's Addiction.
I played Dr. Dre.
Soundgarden. New Dre or old Dre?
Chili Peppers. All the good bands.
1999.
Okay, so after
2001.
After 2001.
You know what the kids are listening to nowadays? 2 Chainz and
Rihanna. What do I put on? Macklemore?
I'd rather hear some Gene Pitney myself.
Should I put on Rihanna?
Gene Pitney. Who is that?
Yeah, well, I don't know what that is.
You can just Google Gene Pitney.
I know music pretty well, and I've never heard of that guy. That must be someone from the 40s.
He hit his peak, I think, in about 1960 or so. So
you're a big Burt Bacharach fan, too. Prospect
Pulse. We welcome back to NHL Midweek, and I'm sure he was thrilled to have to listen to that. Kyle Kozier is the director of amateur scouting with Veritas Hockey. Kyle, we had a Saskatchewan theme earlier in the show, and of course, you being from Saskatchewan, you're going to continue that theme.
Yeah, actually, I felt the disturbance. I knew you Manitoba guys were talking about Saskatchewan people, so I felt the ripple.
I figured as much. Kyle, anyways, we're going to spend the next 10 or so minutes talking about some of the prospects of the Colorado Avalanche. We are going in order, of course, from 30 to number 1 in terms of how the prospects are ranked and the depth charts are ranked for teams. The Colorado Avalanche are not ranked very highly, number 28 in the NHL in terms of their prospects. First guy I wanted to start with is sort of a sad story. He was their first round pick in 2010, Joey Hishon. He was drafted 17th overall. He played junior for, I believe,
Owen Sound?
Pardon me?
I think it was Owen Sound.
It was Owen Sound, and he was playing in the Memorial Cup, and he was playing against the Kootenay Ice in the Memorial Cup, and he took a shot to the head, an elbow to the head, from Braden McNabb, who's now with the Buffalo Sabres.
Yeah.
And the guy hasn't played a hockey game in more than a year.
Right. Now,
what was his ceiling if he was healthy?
I saw him play at the U18s in Fargo here just a few years back, and he was excellent for Canada. I think he led them in scoring, and he was all over the place. So, you know, I think realistically, he's a little undersized, but still a pretty good little center. So I'd say maybe that second line center as a top end. But again, had some pretty good offensive skills and had a little bit of sandpaper to him too, despite his size. Like I say, he was all over the place and played in played a variety of different styles. And but again, still has those, you know, higher end offensive skills that I think would sort of accurately fill that second line role. So, you know, I think last I heard he's skating a little bit here. So you really hope the guy comes around, at least gets a shot, because it's kind of, gosh, it'd be tough to, lose a career early at that early age.
KK, a guy that we wanted to ask you about, he's from Winnipeg, obviously, so it gives it a nice local feel. But Calvin McCard is a guy that was drafted by the Colorado Avalanche. He was drafted the second round, 49th overall. And, you know, he's a guy, he's only 20 years old, 1992 birthday, but how is he developing? And is he a guy that a couple of years from now might be given a chance to play in Colorado?
Yeah, I really think he could be. Colorado, you know, despite them being sort of ranked lower in terms of organizational depth in terms of prospects, are fairly deep in net. You know, they got Cal Pickard, they got Kieran Millan and Ken Patterson and Sammy Adekalo. And to Pickard's credit, it's sort of risen to the top. He's playing a lot of minutes at Lake Erie. So, and all these guys are right in the same cluster, that sort of 1990 to 1992 born cluster. And he's sort of separated himself a little in terms of what's there. So he's really, I guess, a bit of an interesting story, too, in that he's posting better numbers as a professional in the American League than he did in the Western League. Of course, on a Seattle team that wasn't great all the way through, but he's again, it looks like he's improved his game, and that's kind of nice to see from a goaltender too. Is obviously, you know, it takes a little longer for them to mature, but again, he's putting up better numbers now. I wouldn't be super surprised to see him in a Colorado net in the future. Again, they have a bit of a question now. Varlamov is still fairly young, but if he keeps developing, I wouldn't be surprised to see him there.
Kyle, moving to the back end, Stefan Elliott, what's his ceiling?
Well, you'd like to think that he's a capable of sort of fulfilling that power play specialist role. Doesn't have a lot of physical play. Was up and down with the Avalanche. Seems like the last Avalanche game I saw, it seems like Tyson Barrie's stolen a little bit of his thunder there. Mm-hmm. Barrie can play, has a bit of a physical element to his game despite being a little smaller. He put up such monster numbers, I think 80-plus points in his last year of junior. You'd like to think that would translate into that, 40-50 point range in the NHL. Hasn't come yet, but again, I think that the knock is that just no physical play at all, which might limit him to bottom say 5-6 guy that plays a lot of time on the power play.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Kyle Kozier. He's the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey. We're talking about the prospects in the Colorado Avalanche system. Kyle, a guy I wanted to talk about, he played in the OHL with Mississauga. He was a second-round pick in the 2008 NHL entry draft, and we know it takes defensemen a little longer to develop. Cameron Gaunce, if you want to be use his full name, is playing out in Lake Erie right now. Does he have a good possibility to crack the Avalanche lineup, and sort of how does he project, as an NHL defenseman, if at all?
Well, that's, a good question right there. It seems like he's regressed a little bit this year in terms of the production he's put up. Never really supposed to be an offensive type guy, more of that steady, maybe 3-4 defender, plays a competent role, a little bit physical, but all throughout his junior career and actually into the professional ranks as well, he's putting up fairly respectable numbers for a guy that, in that 20 to 25 point range. So, again, respectable for a guy that's not really there to provide offense. Now, he's quite a bit off the pace this year. Like, his numbers have been essentially cut in half. About 20, 25 games to go here in the American League schedule. So it'll be sort of in tough to match his career total. So that's not something you really want to see from a younger defenseman like that. I guess you never quite know what's going on with guys coming, in and out of the team and going up and down to Colorado. So it might be just, case of a bit of a fluctuation there too. But again, one of those more of a depth defender type. And given what's been happening in Colorado in terms of injuries and not going well this year, maybe a guy you bring up and take a look at and see what you got before you have to move forward with him.
KK, another guy, another center, he played for the University of Michigan last year, Luke Moffitt. How does he project and where does he rank as a prospect right now in the Colorado system?
Well, that's one of the interesting things in terms of the prospects that Colorado has is they have a lot of the lower end guys that would sort of project to be a third or fourth liner. Moffitt was a big scorer as a midget, played CompuWare, I think. But again, those numbers have sort of slowly tapered off as he's risen, you know, went to the national development team, of course, at the University of Michigan. I think as a freshman, played on a fairly deep team, and again, respectable numbers for college in that, you know, 8 to 10 goal range. But again, it's sort of, again, slowly tapered off. So if he's willing to commit to becoming sort of that two-way depth forward, he can certainly find a role in the NHL. Skates reasonably well. Doesn't have any kind of game-breaking speed or anything like that, but competent enough to play at the NHL levels. Whether or not he wants to commit, you know, to that defensive role, because I think sometimes guys growing up being the big-time scorer and being, you know, a big scorer even at the midget level, sometimes you get it in your head that you're a scorer, and it takes several years to sort of convince yourself that, you know, your job's going to be as a checker. So again, that I think a large part of whether or not he proceeds into the NHL will be sort of that mental part of the game.
You know, big picture here, Kai, look at the Colorado Avalanche. Haven't been good for a long time. Why is the system so bad?
You know, that's what I don't know. Like, on paper, some of the picks look okay. Just really hasn't translated into anything. Not a lot of guys moving on to the NHL roster. So I don't know if that's the case of, so many of those great picks from when they were still the Nordiques, and it just sort of looks bad in comparison. But just going up and down the list of guys they have in the system and coming along, there's nothing really to, get super excited about. So it seems like you see a lot of the scouts around. If it's just a few misses here and there, or just, you know, it's such kind of a crapshoot in terms of where you pick guys. I guess the nice thing is they have taken a couple of late-round flyers on guys like, you know, Nate Condon was a pretty skilled guy, played in the USHL and at University of Minnesota, and Paul Carey, a guy playing out in Boston in the NHL now. So guys with some offensive skill, maybe they can come around and, you know, to get one of those late-round sleepers that Detroit is somewhat sort of patented, I guess. But, I can't really point to one thing that one organizational failing in terms of why their prospect pool is not that deep.
That's leave you on this last note. That's the guy I wanted to ask about. That's Nate Condon. I mean,
yeah.
You would know him from your times. He was the Fargo Force of the USHL, so you would know him well from there, and you would probably know him also well from the University of Minnesota. He's been there for the last 3 years. What about his game? I mean, and like you said, do they potentially have a diamond in the rough here?
That is a guy that's got high-end speed and high-end skill, and especially, you know, at the USHL level, could just blow right by guys, and that's, again, a fairly high-end junior league, and his speed was really just above and beyond what most other teams could field. His production, again, even now he's moved on to the University of Minnesota, playing on a very good team there, his production has gone up quite a bit now as a junior. It looks like he's putting it all together, but sort of the knock on him was that had all this talent, just couldn't, you know, quite get everything together at one time. You know, he could, you know, work on his speed game, but the hands would fall off. He could work on the scoring, but the speed would falter a little bit. Now it looks like it's coming together. It's too early to tell. It's really a small sample size, one season on a really good team. But if he puts that together, you know, as a seventh-round pick, what the heck? If he turns into a guy that can play on the roster, then great. Then maybe it makes their prospect pool look a little better.
Kyle Kosher is the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey, and he joins us weekly for Prospect Pulse. Thank you, as always, for joining us on NHL Midweek.
Yeah, no problem, guys. I just want to comment real quickly. I like that Ezzy mentioned all those cool bands from the 90s, and I know for a fact he has a staggering collection of Venga Boy CDs, so don't let him fool you guys.
Kyle, you're a beauty. The pride of Saskatchewan, the pride of the legal curve. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, fellas. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye.
You're listening to NHL Midweek, one final segment when we come back. Ezzy's new theme song. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Getting the dance party started a little bit earlier than normal.
You know why this is a good song? Because, Drew, you always throw me under the bus.
The bus actually feels bad after that happens, is what I...
Yep. And it's kind of a happy song, too. That sound effect that Reem always plays from the movie Speed is always great.
Is that where it's from, Reem?
No, I don't know why Ezzy thinks it's from Speed.
Yeah.
I just found it.
All it's because I'm on Speed right now.
One final segment.
Over under.
Over-under for this Wednesday evening will focus on the Ottawa Senators. The Ottawa Senators somehow have just been able to maintain their tremendous pace despite suffering just a world of injuries. They, you know, currently still, I believe, in fourth place in the Eastern Conference, if I'm not mistaken. Fifth place, tied for fourth with Boston, only a point behind first overall in the Eastern Conference. So we'll focus on the Ottawa Senators for over-under. Ottawa Senators goaltender Craig Anderson currently leads the NHL with a goals against average of 1.49. His previous career best came in 2009-2010 when he recorded a goals against average of 2.63 in 71 games with the Colorado Avalanche. Since becoming a bona fide number one NHL goaltender in 2009-2010, his typical goals against average has been 2.54. Over under Craig Anderson finishing the year with a goals against average of 1.95.
Ooh, 1.95. That's, you know what? It's, I think he's going to be close, and that's again why you pick these numbers.
That's right.
You have, do you have like a supercomputer, or do you just calculate these in your mind? I'm going to say under, because he's been playing really well, and he's always had a low goals against, even though this would be a lot lower. But, you know, he's got a pretty good defense in front of him, even though it's decimated right now. But I'm going to go under.
I'm going to go over. It's hard to sustain such a low GAA, Drew, especially considering the injuries that they've incurred. You know, people are playing, and Paul McLean's doing a heck of a job there, but I just don't see it. I don't see them sustaining that for the duration of the season.
Over under.
Through 17 games this season.
Over under the delay in Remus doing that.
Wait, am I supposed to do that after
everyone?
Yeah,
I like you doing that after everyone.
Okay. I'll take under.
Yeah.
You like that, Adrian?
Yeah.
You have to tell Remus that you want him to do it.
Yeah.
You know what, Reem? Don't worry about it. Don't listen to these guys.
No. We didn't have time for over under last week, so I'm week off.
What took longer, Drew asking the first over under question or you pressing the button there?
Okay, sorry.
You're going to be disappointed then.
You have to ask that in over under like format. It's like Jeopardy. You have to ask. The question is the answer. The answer is the question. Hold on. That didn't make sense.
Through 17 games this season, Sergei Gonchar is averaging 24 minutes and 7 seconds of ice time per game. That is his most ice time per game since 2009-2010, when he averaged 24 minutes and 24 seconds in 62 games played. Prior to Erik Karlsson being injured, he was averaging 23 minutes and 58 seconds of ice time. Since then, he has been averaging 24 minutes and 18 seconds of ice time. At the end of this season, Sergei Gonchar's average time on ice will be over or under 24 minutes and 15 seconds per game.
I think over, Drew, because I think one of the factors in that is he's in the last year of a deal. Might as well just wear him out. I mean, you know, he took the 3-year contract in Ottawa. And he took the cash and let them ride him out. 5.5 cap it. He's over 35 years old. I think that, you know, they have the injuries to Cowan, the injuries to Karlsson. Why wouldn't they play him as much as possible? The alternatives aren't great.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Richie. You got to ride your veteran horses, Chris Phillips, Sergei Gonchar. So I think, you know, Carlson's not coming back in the regular season. Unfortunately, it's a shame because he's the defending Norris Trophy winner. But I think with Gonchar, you know, everyone thinks of Gonchar again as, you know, this one-dimensional power play guy, but he's a pretty good defenseman. You know, he's better offensively than he is defensively. But I'm going to say over because they have to go with him. You look at the guys that they have, Mark Methot's good, and other guys, but they've got AHL defenseman Peter Wierkoch playing right now as one of them who's been there the whole season. He got a couple points when he was in Winnipeg. But you got to play Gonchar as much as you can because the alternatives are not able to handle the big minutes yet.
Over under.
The Ottawa Senators have played 20 games so far this season. Through those 20 games, their leading scorer is Kyle Turris with 12 points, putting him on pace for a total of 29 points at the end of the regular season. The Ottawa Senators will have over or under 0.5 players finish with more than 32 points.
Couldn't you just say one player?
Yeah. Well,
no.
Over,
meaning it's over
one.
Under.
This is getting confusing. I don't have my scientific calculator.
If you think he'll have one player finish with more than 32 points, you pick over.
I think under, Drew. I think they're going to be a collective. I mean, if it's anybody, I think it's probably Alfredsson picking up the slack. But I don't think anybody on this team is going to be able to produce, especially without Spezza. I mean, obviously Spezza produces for himself, but also he creates from Mihalik and He's had injuries, don't get me wrong, but he produces for other players, and so does Carlson. So without those two guys on the roster, not only do they not put up their points in excess of the number you just mentioned, they don't also set up the other players because they're such great passers.
Oh, yeah, Richie? Well, I'm going over. I say Alfie gets more than 32 points, but it'll only be those two. But I'm going to say Alfie passes that threshold. He has some work to do.
Yes, he does.
But I think he'll do it.
Okay.
Over under.
Ottawa Senators right winger Chris Neal is currently tied for third in the NHL with 68 penalty minutes in 20 games, putting him on pace for 163 minutes in penalties this season. Since joining the Ottawa Senators in 2001, Chris Neal has never been lower than 20th in penalty minutes in a season. Only twice has he been out of the top 10 in penalty minutes. In his 10-year NHL career, he averages 186.1 penalty minutes per year. Over under Chris Neal finishing third in the NHL in penalty minutes this season.
Ooh. He finishes fourth.
Correct.
Below. I'm going to go under. I mean, I think Chris Neal is a guy who we know when he was in Winnipeg he can score. But he's a guy that, you know, teams come, they know that Chris Neal is going to give them a hard time and fight. But I think, you know, as the season goes along, he's getting older, and I think he's going to fight less than he was earlier in the season. So I'm going to go under.
I'm going to go over, Drew. He's going to cause havoc. He's Chris Neal, and if he doesn't cause havoc, sticking up for his teammates and doing all that, then he's not playing his game. And so I think especially they want to seem tough with what's happened to the team. With Carlson and such, I think they want to be a tough team to play against, more so because they don't have as much skill.
Keep your eye on.
Keep your eye on wraps up the show for this week. I will start with Richard Pollock. Richard, what should our audience keep their eye on?
Well, I think you got to keep your eye on the Philly defense. I think at some point in time there's going to be a move made by Philadelphia. It may not be today, may not be tomorrow, or even this week, but I think you got to keep your eye on that team because they're on TSN2 right now. That defense is not the kind of not one that I think they're going to run with, and you might see some teams. You saw a couple, you know, deals. You saw the one with Ryder and Cole yesterday. I think some of these teams are going to jump the gun and realize that the season is shorter. It's more difficult to kind of read what's going to happen, and you may have to address a need earlier rather than later. So I'd watch the Flyers on the back end.
That's not what I wanted you to play at all, Remus. Keep your eye on, Ezzy.
I'll just make this quick because I know we don't have... Okay, well, maybe you have a little bit more time. I'm going to say keep your eye on Alexander Killorn, not Alexander Kilborn. He's played in 9 games for the Tampa Bay Lightning, was recalled from the AHL, Norfolk Admirals. He was recalled, and he actually has 5 points in 9 games. And, you know, a little side note, he went to Harvard and actually was a pretty good hockey player there. And as you know, I was admitted into Harvard, but I couldn't go. I had other things going on in my life. So that's what we have in common. Mm-hmm. So
the Harvard School of Bartending.
I'd like to give a shout out to a fellow Harvard guy.
Okay.
So Alexander Killorn on the Tampa Bay Lightning, keep your eye on him.
I'll wrap up keep your eye on with telling people to keep their eye on the situation in Florida between the Panthers and Steven Weiss. Weiss is an unrestricted free agent after this season, and he was recently benched for the majority of the third period in a 4-1 Panthers loss. After the game, Panthers coach Kevin Dineen said the decision to bench him was easy based on Weiss's recent play. Now that the trade market has loosened in the NHL, expect to hear a lot about Weiss and trade rumors in the coming weeks.
There you go.
That's it for this Wednesday night and NHL midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Brad Treliving, the Vice President of Hockey Operations and Assistant General Manager of the Phoenix Coyotes. A big thank you to Dan Wood, the Anaheim Ducks color analyst. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes as well as on IllegalCurve.com and on TSN1290.ca. Remember to follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Saturday morning, we return with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show at 8 a.m., 8 a.m. till 11 a.m. Saturday morning as we get you caught up on everything regarding the NHL's Winnipeg Jets ahead of their game against the Washington Capitals. For producer Remus, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Good night and good luck.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mindell, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.